This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. According to Pew Research, more than a quarter of American adults now consider themselves spiritual but not religious. It's a growing trend that spans age, gender, race, and political affiliation. So what does this new spiritual demographic want? And what's the best way to access spiritual guidance? For author and scholar Rabbi Rami Shapiro, an ancient philosophy called perennial wisdom gets to the heart of what most of us are truly looking for. Rabbi Rami Shapiro's book is aptly called Perennial Wisdom for the Spiritually Independent. He's giving a number of talks around the state and joins me in the studio now. Rabbi Rami, welcome. Good to have you here.
Nice to be here, Frank. Thanks.
What are we talking about, this notion of being spiritual and not religious? Is it people, do you think, leaving the restrictions of religion, fed up with that, or are they truly looking for something else?
Oh, I think it's both. Yeah. I think they're looking for, like everyone else, they're looking for meaning and purpose and insight, awakening, enlightenment, whatever they call it. But they're also leaving what they consider to be highly politicized, organized religion. Doesn't matter what the religion is. I mean, yeah, a lot of them are leaving it. The statistic you shared with adults, like a 25% of adults moving out, it's way higher with millennials. It's in the, well, the last thing I read was in the early, the lower 30s already percentile. They're just, they've had it. But they're not necessarily leaving Jesus, and they're not necessarily leaving, you know, any affiliation with anything. You know, they're not walking away from everything they learned as kids,
right,
but they're walking away from the organized church.
I think that's the interesting part. It's not just slacking and saying, I don't want to show up at church on Sunday. I sleep on Sunday. It's, no, there is something I want to find, and I'm not going to do it by this route. So people are looking.
Yeah, yeah, they're looking. All kinds of teachers, all kinds of retreat centers, all kinds of events they go to. I mean, some of it is within what we might call the general frame of religion. So, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism, Judaism, Islam, etc. Some of it is very New Age, very, I guess, spent a weekend with some thousands of amazing people who are interested in alien life forms and UFOs. And when I talked to them and I said, well, what are you looking for? It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the wisdom. No, I don't believe in God, but I think there are aliens, and they have the truth. They know they know what's going on, so they approach their alien, their alien overlords,
right? With something out there. What's so perennial wisdom? This is something, in a sense, in one way, new, when people are leaving established religions, but they're going back to, in many ways, something that's even older, this perennial wisdom tradition. Tell us about that, where the term comes from, but more importantly, what it is.
Yeah, well, the term is that, you know, it's like a perennial flower, I guess, keeps blooming.
Right.
And the idea is that there are four points to it, and I'll list them in a second, but they just keep coming back over and over and over again. But they exist in the mystical depths of every religious tradition. And the four points are real simple. Everything is a manifesting of a singular reality. So you can call it God, Brahman, nature, mother, spirit, Allah, whatever. You know, the languaging depends on the culture from which you come. But the idea is that you and I and everything else, animate, inanimate, sentient and non-sentient, everything is an expression of the divine, the way every wave is an expression of the ocean. Point two of the perennial wisdom is that you can know this directly, either through science, you can know it through meditation. There's, you know, different ways that people seek out truth. And in this case, we are humans, are hardwired to know this. Third thing is, when you know it, you always act justly and with compassion. You don't need a commandment. Mm-hmm. You need a community who'll say, well, wait a minute, I get it. We're all for justice, but what does justice mean in this situation? Right. So you want to talk to people and get and work it out. But it never occurs to you to do anything that prohibits the flourishing of other living things. And the fourth point of the perennial wisdom is that this is why you're born. This is the highest human calling. And you find it everywhere. And what I'm interested in and why I wrote this book is to identify the four teachings in the various religious languages and show that, hey, they all have it.
Right.
And It's right here for you if you want to find
it. They all have it, and they always have. And you will find mystical teachers, and if you're open to it and alert enough, you can read the prophets in every one of those traditions who have said nothing but that. And yet, it seems that these religions cannot help but gain the trappings of power and whatever particular political and social milieu. They seem to reflect the political and social milieu, which falls into hierarchy, injustice, and anything but a sense of belonging to something greater than themselves.
Once the religion becomes an organization, it's all about power and control. So then the teachings are irrelevant. You know, it's just about how do I keep people in my orbit and how do I keep them funneling money to me? And you can't do that by saying, well, you're already divine and you can know this and act lovingly and it really doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah.
No, I need to tell them I have the answer. It's very expensive, but it's worth every penny. And, you know, and let's work out a payment plan.
So exactly. And it's transactional, too. Like if you do this, then you'll get that. We all sort of believe that, you know, wash your hands before you eat and I'll keep the Philistines from taking your sheep or whatever the deal is.
Exactly. I mean, that is classical, especially Western religious theology. It's called FTTT. First this, then that. So you follow the diet, and the Bible says, do what God says, and God will give you the rains in the proper season, and your cows will grow fat, and your kids will grow fat until it's the modern age, and then you'll have to go on a diet because fat is bad. But, you know, they didn't know that. Yeah. And then you get to the book of Job, and Job goes, thanks for playing, but it doesn't work.
Right. Turns everything on its head.
Yeah.
Was it Elijah or Elisha? Who heard the small wee voice when
Elijah.
He was listening? Elijah hearing. I mean, that turns everything on its head. Everybody's waiting for the big. In fact, he's just had the battle of the gods and he wins, right? And he wins with water and not fire. So all of a sudden, we should be alert to the fact that something is amiss here. It's not the bombastic, right, that is God. And then he finally gets the word and it's a whisper. How disappointing.
Right. Well, first
you want God to yell, back, don't you?
Well, at minimum, you want God to sound like Charlton Heston.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what we're trying to do. But you know, the God, the Hebrew God against Baal, and the Hebrew God wins. But then he also kills the 250 prophets of Baal. I mean, the Hebrew God is he's the biggest rocket man, and he doesn't mind pushing his button. You know.
Right.
So there is that. But the thing that interests me about the Elijah story is he comes out, you know, God's not in the earthquake and not in the whirlwind and not in the fire. And that's where we always look. We look for the big flash things. And then the Hebrew is a little dicey to translate into simple English. You know, this is the definitive translation. Yeah. But one way to read it is he hears the voice of God in the fragile voice of stillness, and because it's so fragile, because silence is so hard to maintain. And then what does the voice say? That's to me the main thing. The voice says, why are you here? Well, that's the question. Why are we here? Why am I doing this?
Right.
And you know, there are a couple of things that I think an authentic, and now I'm defining authentic this way, so an authentic encounter with the divine, however you understand God, always answers or at least deepens your question of why am I here, but always pushes you toward the book of Genesis, chapter 12, verse 3, where God says that we're here to be a blessing to all the families of the earth. That's your job. And it doesn't say Jewish families, and it doesn't say human families. It's all the families.
Right.
So as we come back to the text generation after generation, we can understand it more deeply. And I think if your spiritual and or religious path doesn't make you a blessing to all beings, something is wrong with either the way you're living it or what you're being taught.
And the something wrong is a way of seeing. It's very hard for us not to see ourselves as separate from the rest of the world, and particularly in a world and in a culture that valorizes, that sees it as a virtue to have yourself stand apart from others, right, and accumulate as much stuff as you possibly can for yourself. So how do you get to this way of seeing yourself as part of the one? Because you don't do this with some white knuckle determination. I'm going to be nice to everybody. I don't care what they said to me. I'm going to be. You know, it's not going to get there, right? Unless you really sense that you are that other person.
Right.
And the Good Samaritan, if you're not the guy on the ground, you're probably going to keep walking on down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is, technically, there is no way to get there. Because the whole idea is, stop trying, in a sense. You've already got it. You know, the Bible says it's, yeah. I mean, it's in the Hebrew Bible, and then Jesus does it, his own version of it. But if you imagine it's in the sky, then, you know, Moses says, who's going to go up into the sky to get it? And if you think it's across the ocean, who's going to, you know, who's going to go across the sea? And Jesus says, if you think it's in the sky, the birds get it before you do. And if you think it's across the sea, the fish get it before you do. It's within you. It's as close to you as in the Islamic tradition, they say, you know, Allah is as close to you as your jugular vein. Mm. So it's right there. Our problem is we keep looking elsewhere. There's a wonderful story about Mullah Nasruddin, who's a – there's debate. Is he real or is he fictional? But I don't care about those debates. He's a Sufi saint, and he teaches through humor and sort of – he's a crazy wisdom teacher, they call him. Anyway, there's a story about him, and he's under a lamppost. You know, when these lamps are not electric, they're, you know, torches. And he's looking on the ground, and people walk by, and they say, Mullah, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking for my keys. I lost my keys. Oh, goodness. So they all come down. They're all crawling around on the ground trying to help him find the keys. And they can't find him. And they say, well, where did you drop them? He said, I dropped them over there in my house. Why are we looking out here? And he goes, because the light is better out here. And that's the problem. We're looking in the wrong place.
But we do. So here's the thing. Here's my question is, what an easy lesson is this? If we out of the Christian tradition, but you say it's in every tradition where the great mystics and teachers will tell you it's here. You can't get it. You've got it.
Right.
There's nothing you can do to get it besides you have it.
Right.
You don't get to eternity after you die. It's already here.
Right.
Okay, there it is. What a simple message. How is it that we find it so difficult to take that on board and we continually build institutions that work, not only don't help us see that, but actually work against it?
There's something, I mean, we just can't, this is not an answer. I'm just, I guess, repeating what you just said. There's something about us that doesn't allow us to take yes for an answer. And we've got to make it difficult. If it isn't hard, it can't be worth anything. Yeah. So we make it hard. Some religions, this is my take on Zen Buddhism, for example. I spent 10 years studying Zen, sitting, you know, in with a Zen teacher who I loved dearly. And you're really working hard to get enlightened, only to reach the point where you realize you've completely wasted your time. But it's that's the moment of awakening. It's like, wait, it doesn't work. Bam, it doesn't have to. I got it. It's over. Thank you for wasting 10 years of my life. It took me that long to get it.
Well, it raises another question, you know, because I think there's that great story in the Zen tradition where the teacher asks the master, what must I do to gain enlightenment? And he says, you can no more bring on your enlightenment than you can make the sunrise. The student's crestfallen. I've been doing this for 30 years, fasting, you know, learning the sutras. Well, what have I been doing? And the master says, well, so that when the sun does rise, you're awake to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so but that does mean that there is, and all the great teachers will tell you this, stop looking, call off the search, right? Drop your guru. And yet they all had gurus and they searched. So it means there is some kind of a process for us, isn't, even though it's right here, when we have been raised the way we have in a culture that continually pushes us away from this truth, it does take a little work to get back.
So let me put this in two different contexts. One, very quickly, the Hindu and then the biblical. So in the Hindu tradition, they talk about four stages of life. You have the student stage, the householder stage, the spiritual seeking stage, and then the sage stage. And it's all specific to your age and your place in life. So when you're in the student stage, your job is not to get enlightened. Your job is to learn whatever you need to learn so you can then move into the householder stage and raise a family and kids and grandchildren and whatever else. And when you've done that, assuming you've provided financially for your family, then you start, you retire and you find your guru and you learn everything. And then when you're done with that, you realize now the work is to go back and to be the old person in the village who knows something. So I like that stage kind of thing. But in Judaism, there's an interpretation of the death of Sarah. So, you know, after the near death of Isaac, the next chapter is called Chaye Sarah. It's the life of Sarah, but it's her death. She dies. And the Bible has this archaic way of saying it. And the Bible says Sarah lived 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. These are the years of Sarah's life. But Hebrew is often multidimensional. So you could say Sarah lived 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. These are the two lives of Sarah. That's equally valid reading of the Hebrew. And then the rabbi said, well, what are the two lives? And I came up with all kinds of things. But the one that I like best is Sarah is paradigmatic of all people. And we have two lives. Life one is the longer, and it has two stages. One's 100 years and one's 20 years. Don't take the numbers literally. It's just one stage. Life one, phase one is long. Life one, phase two is much less long. And life two is really short. Life one, phase one is we're out to get stuff, money and cars and I don't know what, if you use an iPhone, but I'm not anywhere near iPhone 10. I'm still trying to stretch for the 10. And when I get the 10, I got to have the 11 and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we're getting all this stuff. And then you hit a certain age, a certain point maybe, if not an age in your life, when you have all this stuff. And you look at it and you say, is this all there is? You know, like Elijah, why am I here? And you're not here for stuff. You say, ah, I'm done with that. I'm not materialistic anymore. I'm going to become spiritual. And that's life one, phase two. And the rabbis say that life one, phase two is you live that one with the same mindset as life one, phase one. So you're no longer trying to get the next iPhone. You're trying to get the next guru. You're trying to get the next spiritual book or the spiritual fad or spiritual, you know, and we in America especially, I mean, I've listened to people argue about the best yoga mats and the best yoga clothes.
Exactly.
And I would say, you know, in India, the yogis are running around naked in the jungle.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the men have heavy rocks tied to their testicles. And that's how they're doing their yoga. And there's always someone who says, where do you get the best rocks?
That's right. I've got this nylon rope. Right. It doesn't chafe. You know,
take it one step further. So eventually you've got every book and every guru and every, you know, retreat, and you go, is this all there is? And then you hit life two. And life two is when the whole thing falls apart. You say, oh, I got it already. I always had it. But the point is you have to go, you have to exhaust all other aspects until you're finally, oh, I had it all along.
That's the bottoming out or reaching bottom that at any addiction
program
to talk about,
right.
You can't really recover. And if we talk about people who are, all of us who are utterly misguided and whose vision, who can't see the simplicity in this, then we need to get into recovery, right? I mean, that's essentially what we need to do.
Well, you know, Bill Wilson said in the Big Book, the first thing you have to do is stop playing God. And that's our big problem. And by playing God, he means stop being in control.
Yeah.
Because to control my life, I have to control everyone else's life. And that's exhausting.
How did you come to this? You were obviously raised Jewish. You are a rabbi, and yet you're taking this much broader look at your own religion and others. How did you come to this idea?
When I was 16, in my high school, two teachers spent a summer on some grant in India and came back and were teaching Buddhism and Hinduism, Taoism and Confucianism. I took the class and went, wow. And I started right away. Zen just spoke to me then. And I started to meditate, and I had some experiences with that. And I said, this is it. And I kept doing my Jewish thing because honor your parents, right? So, but my spirituality was all about Buddhism. And at one point, without going on forever on the story, but at one point I'm with a Zen master. I'm graduating college, and he had heard I was planning on getting a PhD in Buddhist studies. And he took me aside privately, and he said, that is the worst thing you can do. Studying Buddhism at a university is a waste. You go to the monastery, you live with me, you learn Japanese, we study the text, we practice all day long, and you'll get what Buddhism offers, which is awakening. And I didn't want to do that. And I said, Roshi, oh, that's great. Thank you so much, but I can't do that. I'm going to be a rabbi. And I didn't know that. I was going to be a professor of Buddhism. It just popped out.
Well.
And he said, be a rabbi. Be Zen rabbi. I said, okay, I'll be a Zen rabbi, but I'm not coming to the monastery. And then I tried the PhD. I lasted two hours, and I said he was right. It was a disaster. So I switched over to Judaic studies in Judaism. But what I wanted in Judaism is what I wanted in Buddhism, and what I wanted in Hinduism is awakening.
Thank you for helping us arise and awaken, Rabbi Rami Shapiro is a speaker and spiritual scholar, also the author of many books, including Perennial Wisdom for the Spiritually Independent. He is making a lot of talks around the area. He's going to be tomorrow, 7 o'clock, Temple Beth Orr in Raleigh, Sunday morning, Wake Forest Christian Church. And, of course, we have all of that at our website, stateofthings.org. What a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was delightful.
Coming up, North Carolina author Michael McPhee, ordinarily a poet, just written some essays. Please stay tuned.